Welcome to this latest lecture in the NIH Neuroscience Series. My name is Fred Miles. I'm in the Eye Institute, and it's my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Professor Patrick Cavanaugh. Professor Cavanaugh was born in Canada, received a Bachelor of Engineering degree in communications from McGill University in 1968. An interest in artificial intelligence led to a doctorate in cognitive psychology from Carnegie Mellon in 1972. He then took a position in the Department of Psychology at the University of Montreal, rising to the rank of professor in 1984. In 1989, he assumed a professorship in the Department of Psychology at Harvard, where he remains today, and is one of an illustrious triumvirate, the others being Ken Nakayama and Charles Strohmeyer, who established the renowned Vision Sciences Laboratory. His earliest interests centered on short-term memory and neural models of associative memory, and these projects gradually fostered an enduring interest in vision. Professor Cavanaugh is now widely recognized as a leader in research in visual neuroscience and perception, and he's given many keynote addresses to learned societies and international conferences. He's made numerous seminal contributions to our understanding of a wide range of topics, including motion perception, spatial vision, color vision, attentional processes, object recognition, and the links between art and brain function. This last resulted in a particularly beautiful paper in Nature in 2005 that many of you might recall because of its stunning illustrations indicating the liberties that artists can take in convincingly depicting features such as shadows, transparency, reflections, and depth, while blatantly violating laws of physics. Those of us who do not have degrees in physics will always be grateful to him for showing that we are not necessarily handicapped in our ability to appreciate high art. This interest in art stems from his recent work on the contributions of various features such as shadow, color, motion, and texture to representations of form, the nature of internal codes for shape, and how these codes are stored and how they guide the construction of internal models of the three-dimensional world. However, today's lecture will deal with yet another of his interests, which is the role of attention in selecting or creating visual representations, an area of research that has seen a huge resurgence in recent years. The title of his lecture is The Coordinates of Attention. Professor Cavanaugh.
Thank you.
I will apologize to him for his apparel. It is extremely cold here. This is an outside door here, and I think he should be forgiven for his arrangements.
Makes me feel like I'm back at home. I'm going to run through a whole bunch of things. Of course, I brought way too much, and so maybe we can get through to the end part, which is one of my current interests about understanding how non-retinotopic responses function in the brain, how very large receptive fields integrate information across large distances. First, though, just a few points about attention, very ill-defined concept, but one I think we can agree is, or a process we can agree is of extreme importance. In other words, we don't become aware of anything unless we attend to it. So it sets the limit on what we're going to see, so we really ought to know how it works and what its limits are. So if we are, for example, at the pool with our four children or four nephews or whoever they are, let's say there are four of them, and there's a bunch of other kids in the pool, you definitely want to keep track of those four and make sure their heads are above water. So this is not an everyday task, but it's one like many, for example, moving into traffic with pedestrians and bicyclists and other cars. We have to track the key players that we're going to try and navigate around through and not hit. And all of that attention to multiple targets is really a critical aspect often of life and death, especially if you're here in Saigon. Ho Chi Minh City it is. What is it? Yes, Ho Chi Minh City. Okay, so we'll just make some very general categorizations about attention without trying to be in any way controversial. We have three components. Selection map, some people call it a salience map. That's where are the important things? So where is stuff? And this, I assume, is like Rizzolatti and others claim, really a secondary use of saccade maps, for example, in parietal or frontal cortex. And next step, okay, you know where it is, let's go grab something that you're attending to. And finally, now you got it, what is it? So send it off to, let's say, temporal areas for identification. And in all of these cases, what we really want to know is what are the coordinates of attention, what are its spatial, what's its spatial scale? Can you attend down to very small things? How many things can you attend to? Do they interfere with each other? Are they independent or do they interact? Which turns out to be the case. Those are spatial coordinates and temporal. If I'm attending here, right now, how soon can I then attend to the next event or change of scene? Okay, so let's go back to those three components. Selection map, let's say, tells us where an object of interest is. Early visual cortex has, of course, the real stuff, the information, the details that we want to know about. So the selection map doesn't have to recode those details, just has to point to where they are. And as I said, let's assume this is perhaps parietal area LIP or other eye movement areas, which rather than directing motor action to a saccade, to a single target, might, by holding off saccades, represent one or more potential targets. And that may be one way to conceive of selection maps or attention itself, locating where interesting areas are. Okay, so once you know where it is, it tells you where to pick up the information, early cortex, and send that information and not others off to object analysis areas. So there's just a very general overview, nothing in particular out of the ordinary there. But let's look now, first of all, the selection map. What could we say about that using some more behavioral and fMRI tasks? First of all, capacity. As many of you know, unlike early ideas of attention, the idea of a single focus of attention, some nice experiments showed we can have multiple foci. Our recent results with George Alvarez show that, in fact, these limits on attention are hemifield specific. So what we're trying to do here is find signatures of the cortical areas in which attention operates in order to know what those areas are. So we find some hemifield limits, so I'll describe in a moment, for attention's operations. And also visual field limits. You might not have thought about this, but we have trouble attending to stimuli outside of the visual field. You may think, well, how would that ever come up? And I'll show you in a while. So first of all, capacity, one item or more. It's warming up down here. Okay. Thank you. Now, many of you tried this task before. Just to remind you, three of these are going to turn red for a moment. This is from Pollution and Storm. Those are your targets to track. They'll go back from red to green in a second. And you have to keep track of the ones that were red as they keep moving around. And most of us can track maybe four or five. Here we'll only stress you not too much with three of them. So the ones that are red in a moment, these ones, those are your targets. Keep track of them as they turn green. Now you've got some green targets. They're not different from the non-targets, but you know which ones they are. So the question is the sense of what it is to attend to those three items. Clearly, you can't be doing this with a single focus or with eye movements alone because there's three of them. I assume most of you did okay. Many of you could do more than that. Some of us can't even do three. So there is a range of skills here. And professional athletes, among others, do better. Okay. So that was a demonstration for the ability to attend to more than one location at a time. And if we do attribute this to some secondary use of eye movement centers, the idea is having attention be the potential targets of saccades when there's more than one, and that we are suppressing saccades. Okay, so what we've been looking at is how to use a focus of attention to track these items. not much here in this idea. There's, of course, the beam of attention onto our target here. And whenever the object moves within our window of attention, we're just going to update our beam of attention. Okay, so object moved. We move the beam of attention, la-da-da. Now we don't need to really know the motion signals from the object itself. We can compute the object's motion from the control of attention's window. From those of you who know about efference copy, how when we track objects, like say this beam of light here with our eyes, if we do a really good job, the spot is on our fovea all the time and has no motion whatsoever, no motion signals. We're never really that good, but if we were, what it is the signals that drive our eyes are being used to compute the motion of the object as we track with our eyes. Well, the idea here is the same, as when we track an object with attention, we can use the signals that drive our attention to compute the object's motion. So that's a little idea of how to use attention for tracking and what it gives you. Of course, we didn't have one object, we had three, so we'd have to imagine that we have more than one of these tracking operators available to us. Fine. Why is it only four or five? Is there something special about this limit, which had previously been thought of as one, where we now think maybe we can track up to four items at a time? Is that really the case? Does that imply some kind of cognitive architecture for attention, a certain number of slots? In fact, we don't find that to be the case at all, but that's the architecture possibility. What we do find is that each additional target for attention appears to interfere with all the others. And they do so to a greater extent the closer they are. Now, this is a finding that was reported also by Bacall and Cowler for a bit of a different task, where you had to report two targets among several around a ring. And they found the closer they were together, the worse you did. And two side by side was the worst of all. Now, remember, there's letters everywhere, so it's not that you're increasing any interference. You seem to be increasing interference between targets of attention. And the sort of a target-to-target distance gave you an interference zone around each target. Now, that sounds, of course, familiar to many of you as an idea of suppressive surrounds that encircle centers of attention. So if we think of this as our central area of selection for attention, the idea is then that there's a surround that tries, of course, to, in the sense of saccades, to suppress possible other targets, which is the goal, since you want to end up with only a single target for saccades. But if you're trying to use the same mechanism for multiple targets in suppressing the saccades, well, then when the targets get too close together, Mounts also has been working on this suppressive surround for attention, as have some others. When you get two of them close together, they will, of course, interfere with each other, and you do worse. So interference, not fixed architecture, appears to be the cause of the limits to attention. How many things can I attend to? Well, it depends on how close together they are. Also, a nice study by Alvarez, George, and Steve Francaneri showed that there wasn't anything special about the limit of four. What they did was they took the task you just saw where the items are moving around, and they just changed the speed. So they could move very quickly, they could move medium speed, or they move very slowly. And what they found is the capacity goes down, as you might expect, capacity goes down as the speed goes up. Nothing surprising there. However, there's nothing special about the number four here. It's just a smooth function that goes pretty smoothly from high capacity to low capacity. So implying that this is some smooth degradation of performance, nothing special about having four items. And we followed this up with other tests of distance between targets when you're doing two tracking tasks at once. And I'll show you two examples of that. Or just to make another link to eye movements, this is from Adrienne Seifert in work she's done more recently since she left our lab and now is at Vanderbilt. She does the tracking task and has the subject look here, and the items are moving around, and they turn off briefly and they come back, and the little brief pause doesn't really seem to degrade your performance that much. In the next condition, you have the same pause, but you're going to make an eye movement to the other side at the same time. So you go from here, you jump over there, and you have a lot of trouble picking up the targets after the eye movement. So the locations of your attentional points of interest are not in spatiotopic coordinates. They appear to be retinotopic. When you do the saccade, you kind of lose track of where you were. In the last condition, she had you jump over here and then back again, and you're fine. So it wasn't the eye movement itself that created the degradation of performance. It was the change of coordinates. Okay. What do I mean by hemifield limited? This is a task we ran with George. This is George's thesis, one of his thesis experiments. If we think of attention as a central process, we don't really like to imagine that there's kind of a left half of the world attention and a right half of the world attention. We seem to have a very unified experience of our attention to the world. And yet, what George showed, there's George, was that if you have two tasks at the same time, and you're looking in the middle here, as it says, these are going to start to move, and you're supposed to keep track of these four items, two on one side, two on the other. So try this, and there'll be a test at the end. One item will turn red, and you just say yes or no if it's one of the ones you started tracking. Question is, get a judgment of how easy or hard this was, and then I'll give you a second version in a second. Okay? So you had those red ones? You want me to start again? You got the red ones? No? Okay, we're going to start again. Ready? It's the red ones. You're looking at the spot, and you can follow the red ones. Okay, you got the red ones? Here they go. So as before, now you've got four of them rather than three. You're kind of following them around and trying to remember which they were, and then in a moment they're going to stop, and one's going to turn red, and you say yes or no. Is that a yes? Excellent. Okay. So get an impression of how hard that was. And we'll try the next version. Whoops, sorry. Here's the next version. Now it's the same task, same arrangement, but the two panels to track are both in the same hemifield. They're not one in the hemifield, the other hemifield. They're both in the same hemifield. So try this one now. Looking in the middle, follow the four red ones. They start to move. And try and get an impression of whether it's harder or easier. Okay, so you can ignore the fact that up there I said it was harder. I wasn't meant to bias you in any way. And then in a moment, one of them is going to turn red. So yes or no? How many thought that was easier? Harder. Yeah, so it really is a lot harder. Turns out that in the data, let me show you what the data are here. This is when they are in the bottom. We're both in the top. So these two straddle the two hemifields. One test in the left hemifield, one in the right hemifield. The black bar is when you only had to pay attention to one of them. And the white is when you had to pay attention to both tracking tasks. And it hardly cost you anything, or it cost you nothing at all, to switch from just tracking two on one side to four. You got the other two for free. However, when they were both in the same hemifield, when you went from tracking one side, one of the pairs, and added the second pair, kind of disaster strikes. And it's as if, mathematically, it's as if you were only able to do two of them. And the next two you kind of just ignored. So much harder when in the same hemifield, implying that the control of the centers of interest and their interference with each other is hemifield limited. It occurs within hemifields. And that's going to say, well, where does that happen? You know, where are the representations lateralized to one hemifield or the other? It would be limited to those areas of cortex, this kind of control. Now, there is, of course, lots of fMRI data on these tracking tasks. Here's some we did with Jody Cullum did with us. And this, of course, you recognize Nancy Kanwisher's brain. And here's her parietal area becoming active, more active during the tracking task when she had to follow the targets compared to when just look at them passively. Now, of course, parietal areas are lateralized, many of them, showing activity to the contralateral, to visual stimuli in the contralateral field. Okay. Similarly, with parietal patients, I work with Lorella Battelli. When you have parietal lesions, if you have a right parietal lesion, you can no longer track very well on the left. If you have a left parietal lesion, you can no longer track very well on the right. You present tracking in either hemifield separately. Okay. Now, in those same patients, They had no deficits in low-level motion tasks, only in the tracking. They would not be able to track even one with two distractors, and certainly not two targets on one field. But they could very well on the other field. So our idea, very, very simplistic idea, sorry, but here's what we've got. We have these hemifield limits, and we're attributing capacity to the interference between centers of attention. They're sort of suppressive surrounds, the purpose of which, of course, is to suppress distractors. But when you have two centers of attention and they fall within each other's suppressive surrounds, there's a cost to pay. But if these are hemifield limited, then you can bring two centers of attention much closer together without the interference if they straddle the vertical meridian. Okay, so you can think of, I'm sure, many, many cortical areas that have lateralities. That's not much of a constraint, but it is one. And in fact, we've gone a little bit further. One that leads us a bit of astray from the parietal area or frontal areas, which are, of course, important parts of eye movement control and therefore perhaps also for attention. In this one with Tom Carlson and George, we used much smaller tracking tasks. Let me show you here. So look here. You're going to track these two red guys as they start to twist. You got them? Okay, this one isn't too hard because by mistake somehow we've got them almost symmetrically aligned. That wasn't true in all the trials, although occasionally it could happen. They're sometimes reversed. Okay, was that a yes or a no? That was a no. That was a good. Okay, so there was the one, like before, straddling the midline. What we found is this one here is much harder. If you want to try this one, look here. Keep track of the two red ones. And this one was our hardest task. And what was interesting, though, so this is not unlike what I already showed you. What was interesting, though, is not this particular one, but the next one. Because the next one, we found that even when it straddled the horizontal midline, it became easy again. So straddling the vertical or horizontal midline seemed to give you an advantage. Now, I didn't really give you time to start up there. But the data are fairly convincing that either midline. Now, a number of you will know that that's a very particular signature of a certain number of cortical areas, and none of them in the parietal area that I'm aware of. For example, V2, this is a quadrant effect. In other words, hard within a quadrant, easy across quadrants. So we think, we're not sure exactly what this means yet, but we think it is implying that the suppressive zones are not only occurring in the location map, if that's in the parietal, for example, but also in lower cortices when attention is trying to index or identify the location to be selected and surrounds it with some interference. Because very few areas have quadrant structure. V2, V3, V3A, I'm not sure exactly how many. I won't go on. Anyway, so these kinds of results can give us pointers to possible cortical substrates for some of these attention effects. Okay, so selection map is hemifield, maybe quadrant. Well, not the map, but at least the surrounds may be quadrant limited as well. Map guide selection, we're going to go over here. So let's first of all now look at what I mean by a visual field limit. So I'll try and be very quick here. This is a very simple point. But it was a fun experiment to do. What if the target is outside the visual field? Well, normally if the target's outside the visual field, I'm not going to see it. So how can we do this kind of experiment? Well, we're going to actually get stimulations from outside the visual field by going through the whites of your eye. Well, actually, it was the whites of my eye. And the question is, if I get a retinal response, and I assume it's transferred up to the cortex, do I see it? Or is somehow there's a selection or attention gating that knows, hey, that's outside the visual field. I'm not going to let you see this. So this work with Jason Barton. Now, how does this, where do you get this kind of outside the visual field idea? Well, the retina is much bigger than your visual field, and that's because your eyeball is kind of looking around out through the aperture formed by the bones, your bony orbit, cheeks, and nose. And at any one time, if you looked into your eye, you'd see a sort of a kind of area of light, and as your eyeball moved around, that area of light would fall in different parts of your retina. So here's the eye looking straight forward. The information from the scene is falling on the retina. These two little bits on the end are not being stimulated. But if we look down, I'm sorry, I guess I have to say a few things before I make this move. Anyways, we're going to try and get access beyond the visual field. Oh, there, I looked down, sorry. Now if I'm looking down, notice that the cheek is limiting the light coming into the eye to this upper spot, and we've got light coming in all the way to the edge of the retina here from the upper field. Now we've got this huge area of unused retina. And you can just show this to yourself by looking up as hard as you can towards your eyebrow. You can almost foveate, look at your eyebrow. That means that half of your visual field is receiving no light at all. So that's parts of the retina, sensitive retina, available for fun outside the visual field. Okay? Now you can test this area with after images, as David Williams and Mary Hayhoe did. Migraine illusions, as some of us have migraines, can do on our own. TMS, and through the sclera. So let me show you what we did through the sclera. Now you can get through the retina, to the retina through the sclera, as you all know, by poking your eye. Some of you have done this. Just stick your finger in your eye and you'll see a phosphene on the other side. I'm sure you've all done that. If you want to know what's the spatial resolution of those phosphenes, you use a fork. Maybe a plastic fork would be good. Okay, and you can see a couple of phosphenes. You get kind of a resolution. This is important work, so you've got to go to the limits here. What we did is use a fiber optic to deliver light to different parts of the sclera, and then we attached that fiber optic to a contact lens and stuck it in my eye. There's the light going on there. Here it is here. And we put the active spot of different parts in my eye, and then I changed the gaze, direction of my gaze, to bring that flashing light outside the visual field. And when you do, you don't see it. I mean, you can get some of a vague flashing, but when it's in the visual field, there's this lump of solid flashing light, moves outside the visual field, it's gone. Okay, so that means that even though the retinotopic cortex, like V1, is undoubtedly firing and responding, at some point, gaze-dependent gating is happening. In other words, there's some kind of selection of what information will be allowed further up into awareness and higher level visual processing. So some cropping in head center, not retinotopic coordinates. Okay, so overall we had a selection map limited by mutual interference, center-to-center interference, which I think makes a lot of sense if it has something to do with eye movements and the way that saccades, winner-take-all, will normally winnow out possible targets down to the one remaining one. But if you limit that winner-take-all competition and you're left with a few potential targets, you can think of that as the salience map or attention map, points of interest. Okay, so capacity limited by mutual interference. We can measure how big the surround is here by looking at these interference effects between attention centers. Hemifield limited, that gives us a clue about where this might be happening. And of course, our quadrant effect says it may be happening in more than one place. We have yet to digest all of that. Visual field limited means that there's something involving head-based coordinates as well. Okay, the next step. So now you know where to look. Now you got to know, you have to go get the stuff, the selection step. Down here. Let's get some good stuff from visual cortex at the location of interest. Is that for me? Okay. And here, rather than the keeping track of locations, there's a very big difference now. When you really have to select stuff and identify it, there seems to be only one thing at a time. So there really was some truth to the classic notion of a single focus for attention. And we can find out how big that single focus is, how small is the smallest one, the resolution of attention, and do it with a couple different techniques. I'll show you one that I like a lot. But we already know, for example, you can track many items at a time, but a number of people who are doing that kind of task also ask, well, how many can I track and know what they are at the same time? So Sakai is one, or Saiki, sorry, and a number of others showed that, in fact, you're very poor once you have to know whether these things are going to duck behind these little occluding veins, and they come out the other side a different color, and you have to press a button if you saw a color change. Well, in fact, you're very poor at doing that. So you can track where they are, but you can't really track what they are unless you only have about one or so to track. Okay. So here's a list of all the people who have done that. So what's that about? Well, of course, the idea is it's nice to know where things are, but one goal of visual processing is to bring them to identification centers, like the infratemporal cortex, where the receptive fields are really big. I mean, the idea is they're really big, so they can analyze some high-level property, face detection, other kinds of very high-level properties, over a large area of visual field, and give you some kind of position independence of that identification operation. Well, okay, if you have a big receptive field, you have a problem, because it's not always the case that there will only be one item in that visual field. If you have two items, if there's one here, only one at a time, that's fine. This particular cell might not tell you where it is, but it can tell you what it is. But if you have two of them, then you have the classic problem of one big receptive field and two items. How do you know whose lips belong to whom? And for the purpose of the cell, it's just like you just have a whole combination of the two faces, and you don't have any individuation of the two faces within that big receptive field. Well, that's really what attention selection is about, is for. It's to select when there's clutter, there's more than one item, suppress the ones you don't want, and let these bigger receptive fields only see one at a time. So this is a bit, let's see, we're going to start at V4. Here's our target. A little bit higher up, the receptive fields are bigger, but we want to stick to this guy, so attention is somehow going to select him and suppress the other. Remember, center selection, suppressive surround, attend here, and let's assume this continues on to some really big, fat receptive field. Of course, now we know that they aren't so huge, and they do have some retinotopy in infratemporal cortex. Nevertheless, we're going to, at each step, select some subsection so that at the end, even though there's lots of letters perhaps present out in the visual world, we're going to bias competition, support one and suppress the others. Well, that's good. I mean, that's the idea. Again, the problem is going to come up if we have two items too close together so that my smallest area of selection in fact can't individuate one or the other, but only gets both. What's going to happen? Now, the old idea of attention was attention allows you to scrutinize stuff. You kind of attend here, and you can really see the details. But these experiments I'm going to show you that it's not at all like that. If two items are within the smallest area you can attend to, you get mush. You get some kind of combination of the two, and that's been known as a very common, well-known, and long-studied property of crowding. So here's the point again. If you got one item in your center of selection and you've suppressed the distractors, that's fine. That's how it's supposed to work. But if you got two in there, you're sunk. Especially if you can't make this any smaller, if you can't make your region of selection, let's say the attentive field, the receptive field of whatever is doing this attention selection, if it can get no smaller, you're not going to be able to select either of these, even though you might be able to see either of them alone perfectly well. Okay, so the resolution is set by the smallest available selection field. So here's the crowding effect that many of you may know already anyways. If you look at this plus here, and I bring you some letters in there, no problem. You can read all of those letters. So that's really important that you can resolve. These are above the limits of visual resolution. Resolve each letter and read them. So if you imagine a region of attentional selection, you selected this one to read that one, and you suppressed everyone else. You got the letter D, okay, D, and then A, and so on. However, if we bring in some other letters, boom, you're still looking here. I think you'll agree that the original letters, although they were perfectly legible before, are lost in some cloudy, foggy uncertainty of where is the letter and what is it. It's really quite difficult to pick them out. This is a very strong effect. And the idea, again, is if that's my region of attentional selection and the smallest one I have available, then I can't zoom in. I can't pick out any one of them alone. What am I going to get? I got three letters. I can't label any of them individually, so I just get, you know, some letters, some stuff, some texture. Okay, now here's the same point, just to make the point that this is about accessing individual items, not that adjacent letters are somehow interfering with each other. This is about access, because here we're not going to ask you to identify anything, merely to count them. So if you're looking here in the middle, and you try and count even the ones on the right, I know you probably know how many there are there, but try and count through them one at a time. First one, while you're looking in the middle here, of course. First one, second one. I think you'll find that by the third one, it's kind of ill-defined what the third one is. And that's telling you that you really can't isolate this one. In other words, say, I got this one. Okay, now the next one. You can't individuate it. You can't shrink your attentional selection to that scale. Okay, so we've done a number of studies to argue that this really is a function of attention. And so that led us to this simple point that you have, it's really only easy to identify one thing at a time. You might be able to do a bit more than that, but not like the tracking where you can do four things at a time. That's done by picking off an item in the selection, suppressing its surround into these larger object identification areas, into their larger receptor fields. But the smallest size that you can select is actually pretty coarse. If we call that the resolution of attention, if our vision had the same resolution as our attention did, we would be legally blind. In other words, attention is really kind of a coarse look at the world. You have trouble attending to items when there's some others around it. And that's set by this size. So we can measure what the center size is by looking at experiments like crowding. We could measure the outer by looking at those experiments with double targets. So we know a bit more about that now. Let's go from there to the last part. Sorry if I was racing a bit there. I have a little more time to do this last part. This is about, okay, you've selected the item, and you've sent it to this interesting object analysis area, infratemporal cortex or lateral occipital complex or whatever your favorite area is. How can we really study this area on its own? How can we know what are the properties of those cells? Because if we present a stimulus, it's going to, you know, it has to pass through many parts of the visual field, visual system, lateral genicula, early cortices here, before it gets there. How do we know which properties of our visual performance are set by this high-level area and which by the early areas? So what we've done is use moving objects. So this is pretty obvious, if you think about it. And there are some experiments that test responses to objects in motion. But we're trying to really develop an idea here, and I'll try and develop it for you. We hope that this allows us to measure properties of these high-level, large receptive fields. So the basic idea, oh, I'm going to make this a lot more complex. The basic idea is very simple. If, this is with Alex Holcomb, if we have a stimulus that's moving, and we're looking in the middle here, you've got to remember that in the normal scene, most of the time, things are moving on us. You know, if we walk around, if we're looking at things, things are moving on our retina quite a lot. So it's not the usual case that we have a static image in front of us. It's the general case that things are moving. It's only the thing we're really looking at, foveating, as we move in our car or walking, that doesn't really change that much. Everything else kind of moving around. Well, we don't often circle our fovea as this is, but this is easier to do on a computer. So imagine that this item is actually moving pretty quickly. This one isn't, but imagine that it is. And imagine we could set the speed so that it's too fast for any local analysis of the object's identity to complete, if that's how it actually worked, if the objects were identified by retinally specific local analyses. Okay, but let's say we have it going this speed, and yet you can still tell what the object is. Well, that means that something is integrating information over these different locations. As the object moves, there's some kind of spatial-temporal integration. So that's what we're after here, because clearly, there we go, if you want some cumulative non-retinotopic analysis, if we know that each local analysis is insufficient, it's only partial, we're going to have to sum that up somehow. So we need some non-retinotopic analysis. We need a big receptive field that actually maybe doesn't care where the object is within the receptive field and can maintain, can continue its analysis of the object structure even though it's changing location. So that's what we're after. Now, it's not so easy, in fact, to do this straightforwardly for behavioral tests because what we don't know, if we wanted to do this, and we do have some experiments like this, what we don't know is at what speed can we say that there's no local processing anymore? When can we say for sure that the local processing is insufficient for recognition? I mean, we could do that, but it sounds a little bit hard. So we took another route. We're going to use apparent motion. I'll take a couple steps to finish out here. So the object no longer moves smoothly. It kind of steps around. Well, that's okay. But now we know exactly where it is for a certain amount of time. So that's a little better. But now we're also going to mask every location. And we're going to leave, and we just let them alternate on each location. Notice we've lost the apparent motion here. Well, that's too bad. But what we did gain was I can now control exactly how much processing is happening at each location. I can change the timing between the stimulus and the mask until you just can't identify the stimulus anymore. So I can clamp down your local processing until I know for sure you cannot do this based on local processing. Well, that's fine. You say, but what happened to the object in the motion? Well, here it is. We just put a ring around the object. This is the exact same display as before. You know, if you want to hold it, you know, put your hand over the ring, you'll see that. But if you're looking here and I ask you to pay attention to the object in the ring, now you get an object that seems to be moving happily in jumps around the fixation. But I now know that each location that I come to with this object, I know exactly how much local information is available to you there. Because I can separately, without the ring, do tests on how well you identify the object at each location. Okay, so the idea now is I have control over the amount of local processing, and I have you stepping through with the attention following this trajectory of the object as it moves. So we like to call this mobile computation because you're computing from partial information at each location. We're going to have to prove that, but I'll show you in a moment. And we've done a couple of different tests here already. First I'll show you is binding color and motion in a moving target. So we're going to have some dots that are both colored and moving. And rather than having a stimulus and a mask alternating, we're actually going to have two pairings. It's going to be red in and green out, and you'll see it's kind of hard to say which is which. And I can set this rate so that you can't do it. I'll show you this all in a moment. And then I'll let you try and track it with attention, and you'll see what that does for you. Okay, that was one. Another one is crowding. I'll show you an example where we can demonstrate that crowding is, in fact, something that happens in a moving frame of reference. It's not some local retinotopic effect. I'll show you what that is. And finally, I'm not going to show you a demonstration. I can show you that later if you like. Of binocular rivalry, that it also is non-retinotopic, that it's specific to the moving object and not to the retinal location. Okay, so here's the first example, color motion binding. Now remember, our idea here is to find out if there's any kind of spatial-temporal integration where we can prove that the performance is based on integration across space and time, and that's going to allow us to find out what these high-level cells that have large receptive fields and are not so position-dependent within them, what their capabilities are. Okay, so here's the example. This is a demonstration of providing alternation between two stimuli that's rapid enough to prevent local processing. So you're going to fixate here. Okay, now the test here is, all you have to say is whether red is moving in, so it's moving in at the different locations, or is red moving out. Now this isn't going too fast, so you might be able to do this, always looking in the middle, remember. But I think you'll admit that it's kind of a little tough. It's a bit confusing. So keep in mind how hard or easy you found this, because a lot of people differ. And what we usually do in experiments, we ask people to attend to the item at 6 o'clock, the one at the bottom. Although if they get the answer from any other item, that's fine too. And then we vary the rates and we find the rate at which you're really terrible. Okay? So that's the fixed location condition. Now, we're going to do it again, but now there's a ring. Now, this exact same rate, look in the middle, and follow the ring. And first of all, is it red or green? It's red. I mean, that's not very hard. Is it moving in or out? In, okay. So, in fact, this seems, for most people, much, much easier. And yet, it's the identical stimulus, and rather than attending to one location as you were before, now you've got the extra task of trying to move your attention around. Should be harder, you think. But notice the timing is set so that every time the ring moves, it lands on the exact same stimulus. Whereas before, when you attended to one location, you had to say, okay, that's red, and maybe, oh, now it's green, now it's red. Things were changing where you were attending. Your attention window doesn't seem to be very narrow in time, so you seem to see a number of stimuli changing at any one location. However, by the timing, how it's arranged here, as the ring moves around, you've got all the leisure time you want to say, okay, that's red moving in. Okay, well, that seems to be what's going on. With the moving attention, you're able to attend to this moving object and integrate its properties. We'll have to prove that, but that's the idea. Okay, first of all, how big was the effect? My goodness, my data disappeared. Oh, there they are. Okay. Without the guide, this is the rate. Let's say that's 75%. So maybe 2 or 3 hertz, I drop to this threshold level of performance with fixed attention. With the guide, I'm way up here. Okay, and I'm not especially good. I mean, here's other people. I'm about like most of these. This person had a little more trouble. But there's as much as a 300% improvement in the rate at which you can report which color went with which direction. And that seems to say there's something good about moving around. It's certainly an advantage. And what kind of advantage is it really? Well, if you look at this example here, okay, that was the fixed attention. Maybe you're trying to read off here. It's a bit fuzzy there. But let's take two of these locations and see how they change over time. Here they go. So here at the moment, they're green and red. And then an alternating frame, in the next frame, they switch and so on. Now, if I'm attending to one location, what happens? Well, as I said, the attentional, you can't attend to infinitely small moments of time and individuate what's going on there. You can attend, when you attend to something, you seem to have to keep attention on it for about fifth to a third of a second. The attention window is long in time. And that means you're getting confused about, you can't separate these anymore, just like with the crowding in space, here you have crowding in time. You can't separate them, and you really can't say which was red and which was green and what they were doing. So you get some confused response. So attention window can't open and close fast enough to individuate one color and motion. Well, what about with the moving ring? What happens there? Well, let's look at, we get to look at three in a row here. And what do they do? Well, just like before, it's the same stimulus, but now we have a moving ring, and it's going to move one per step, and as it moves, it keeps up with the same stimulus. It makes it almost trivial. I'm just going, well, it's red, red, red. I've taken away the difficulty of keeping my attention at one location, and I let my attention move. And I've got red the whole way, and it's really easy. Fine. Well, maybe that's all that happened. It just was, you didn't have this alternating red and green. What's the real reason for doing so well here? Is it really because there's some integration across space and time, which is what interests us? Or was it just because you got rid of that annoying red-green alternation? Well, if it's just that you got rid of the red-green alternation, is one alternative. The other alternative, which is in this slide, is the integration alternative, which I'm getting a little bit of information on each position, and I'm integrating over time. Spatial theory, that's nice. Okay, but this is what I want to show you. So what experiment we did was, attention, the ring moves around smoothly as before, jumps around continuously as before, but now there's only one site with the stimulus stream. This is going red, green, in, out, and you slide through at high speed, you kind of zoom, and you try and pick off the one item that's within the ring when it's at the bottom. Now, since there's only one item, there's no preceding reds and greens in the as you're picking it out. If all you had to do was get rid of that red-green alternation, you should do just as well with one item as you did with all the items present. But just to check, we put 3 or 5, 2 and 4 as well. In fact, when you come through one item, you do only chance-level performance. As you increase the number of locations, you get up to almost perfect performance. This is across three subjects. So there is an accumulation here. It's a non-retinotopic accumulation of information. This procedure does seem to allow us to measure properties of accumulation across space in large receptive fields, areas that have large receptive fields. What's the time course of this? Well, for the particular rates we used here, it's about a half a second to cover five of them. So we might think that the integration window here is about a third of a second. So we haven't changed the integration window at all. If we take that third of a second and look at the single site, we've got red, green, and we're getting confused. But if we're able to move it across space, we've taken the integration window rather from being at one location, and we've aligned it across space so that it still is open for a third of a second, let's say, but now there's the same stuff in it as before. Let me go all the way back, because I was hand-waving a lot there. This is what I meant. So this is still a third of a second long, but the third of a second isn't obligatorily opened at each location. As I open the attention, as I open a selection window to higher level cortices at a particular location, it's not a property of that location in the retinotopic cortex. It doesn't stay open for a third of a second there, or we would have had just as much trouble if it stayed open a third of a second here. It seems to stay open a third of a second on its way to this higher receptive field, which can integrate over space and time. Okay, and now we go quickly forward for these we saw before. Here we go. Okay, so here's another example next. It's the example of crowding. Remember crowding you saw with the danger? The other letters came in. It was very hard to read a single letter. Now we're going to take this and going to do a slightly different variation where we're going to put a lot of these arrays of targets and distractors on radial arms. Within each arm, there's one target. It's the middle one. It's surrounded by two letters on each side. However, unlike the other case, in this case, the target's on all by itself, and then it's followed by the two distractors, then the target, then the two distractors. And that continues. So at each location, you have this flickering target and surrounding letters. And beside that are more arms doing the same thing. So let's go look at that now. Okay, so you're supposed to look in the middle. You can concentrate on any arm you want. Let's try the bottom arm down here. And you're trying to pick out the middle letter. And I think we'll agree that's a little difficult. Now, the actual experiment is to report whether the letter is mirror image or normal. So if you manage to get to that middle letter, you have to say whether it's mirror image or normal. That would be the response. Now, if you happen to be looking at another arm, it's a different target letter, but it's always the same version, either mirror or normal. Now, if crowding is retinotopic, is some local interaction between these letters, if it's now difficult to read that target letter, then what I'm going to do next shouldn't help you at all. What I'm going to do next is have you move your attention from one arm to the next, helped by this guide. Now, when you do that, you might notice that the item in the beam is always the same item, and you might find that it doesn't have any flankers. It's there alone, as of course it was before, and it doesn't seem to have much interference, so it seems to be a fair amount easier to identify now. What that tells us is that the interaction between the flankers and the target letter is something particular to the target itself. And if the target's moving, it gets interference from anything that moves with it. We've arranged here to have very little moving with it. Whereas at each location where it's stopping here, the target is flanked in the next frame by the flanker, by the distractors. And that was what, if you looked at that local frame, was made it hard to identify the letter. Now, if that interference was local, then as you came through with attention to pick off whatever was there, you should find not much at all there. But the data show that with no guide, the different rates and your percent correct drop pretty quickly. But with the guide, you do very well. That's me. Here's a couple of other. So if crowding were local, moving and fixed crowding should be the same. Crowding depends only on the distractors within the selection window. When you move the selection window and arrange to have nothing else in there, you have unfettered access to the target, saying that the fettering the interactions, the crowding, was not locally based, was not retinotopic. Okay, even if it's moving. And here's three subjects. So the guide helped all three of us. Okay, so what do we learn with mobile computing? These are a few of the experiments we ran. Accumulation across locations is a sign of integration in a position-independent representation. So we're taking that as a signature of areas like infratemporal, lateral occipital complex, with large receptive fields, some retinotopy, but mostly large receptive fields, and that those fields are capable not only of responding to a stimulus at a different location, if you tested it independently in different trials with different locations, but also to maintain and continue analysis of a stimulus, even if it's in motion within the receptive field, something that I don't think has been tested physiologically, but these results would suggest. Okay, the moving integration window reveals selection-specific temporal response function. That's the point that that window stayed open for about a third of a second, but the window was not tied to a particular location every time it opened. It was a trajectory of locations that were accepted, that were taken in during that third of a second. Okay, so to summarize, selection map. We looked at the multifocal, and I like the links between that and eye movement representations, even though I haven't said anything here that would support or challenge that. I think that's a very interesting direction that many others have addressed. we find multifocal. You can select more than one location. The interference between locations seems to be what limits the capacity, but that interference doesn't cross certainly the vertical meridian very well, and maybe not even the horizontal meridian. That helps us identify where this surround suppression acts. And visual field limited, you can't see stuff outside your visual field, even if you stimulate the retina there. So center surround selection, multi-target interference shows surrounds, so we can get an idea of how big this is from looking at these multi-target tasks. When you select to identify rather than just tracking locations, it's much harder to work on more than one target, and the crowding effects, as I showed you, revealed the actual center size. And then finally, we looked at non-retinotopic integration with moving stimuli, where we find position-independent temporal profile of selection, sort of a comet trail of input. I'm not sure that made a lot of sense. But anyways, it sounds nice. Thank you. Yes.
Now, with your motion binding experiment, you used a circle or a wedge-shaped guide to facilitate your attention. But what if your discrimination is just because of this facilitation? So maybe
yes, absolutely.
In a control experiment, you should keep that circle or wedge at the same position, but just alternate it.
Yeah. Well, definitely. So the question was, couldn't it just have been the ring? Maybe the ring or that wedge alone was somehow boosting response, and that's what's happening. So yes, we did a number of controls, like you suggested. We tried at this one single location, so flash, 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 every time with the target. No facilitation. We tried random locations, always with the target in the ring, no facilitation. We even tried, there's more here than you might think, but we tried two locations side by side, wiggling back and forth, and that didn't help either. It seems that's too fast. So the idea after a number of these controls is that what you're really doing is you're guiding attention with a zero phase lag situation. It's a very predictable path, and that means that as the ring comes on, attention is right there. You know exactly there's zero, not zero, but very little temporal and spatial uncertainty. Arrange that. Whereas all these other ones, I can turn the ring on, but it takes a while to get attention there, and by the time I get there, the stimulus is gone. So the predictability seemed to be the key thing. You can't kind of switch it back and forth or move randomly. The ring itself did not facilitate response.
A related question. So if I could see correctly, the red to ring alternation was phased at the same time as the jumps of the ring.
Yes, it had to be that. That was like a mechanical trick, right?
Is it contingent upon that? mean,
yes.
You gain an advantage if you have a maintained attentional trajectory, but it kind of mismatches a little bit there.
Yes, so if we took all the stimuli and had them all red, and then all green, and then all red, now the ring moving with the same speed will see red, green, red, green. So, and then it's not really different than attending to one location where you get red, green, red, green, and you don't do any better. So it's not the moving attention part either. It's not the ring. It's not the moving attention. It's having, within a predictable moving attention, a continuous stimulus. So I've got lots of time to pick out the different features, redness, moving inness, and so on. Yeah, we thought, so we did many experiments saying, we're going to find handoff costs. So yes, we did kind of several different tracking tasks where things would cross over, and we found some cost. In fact, we did one of them, Arash Afraz, who's in our lab now, who came from Tehran, from Esteki's lab. He, in Iran, was able to test a split brain patient. So the thing was, when we're doing normal subjects, there seemed to be a cost, a few percent, 6-10% cost when things would cross over, but not the disaster you might expect. So split brain patient, on the other hand, if there was only one target, she could do this. So the TARDIS went around and one target crosses the midline, she'd be okay. But if two targets or two items cross the midline at the same time, she couldn't tell. So it looks like there are some strategies for a handoff, that as it approaches the midline, maybe there's activity building on the other side that lets continue. But in her case, when there was no communication across the hemispheres, she seemed to have this timing strategy. I know something's going to come, when something's coming, and if only one thing is crossing at that time, she'd pick it up. But when two things were, it was willing to have two things at the same time, there she failed totally. Okay, the rest of us are not split brain, so there do seem to be some very sophisticated procedures that merge attention for the two fields. So it's hard to show that they are different. It was easy when they were actual two tasks in the separate fields. But when things actually start to cross, where you're going to have to pay attention to something crossing the midline, which is the normal case if you're driving, people are crossing all the time, this doesn't seem to be too difficult. So there is a cost you can measure, but it was not the dramatic cost we had wondered about like you did.
In the attention tracking that you talked about right at the beginning, I thought there was evidence that you were tracking objects. If that were the case, doesn't it seem surprising that it doesn't facilitate the performance on discriminating objects?
Okay, are you thinking just tracking objects as if I'm taking the four points like a square or a triangle? Is that what you meant?
Right.
Yeah, so one of the theories of why we can track multiple objects is that, in fact, it's only one object. And many of you doing the 3 points might have felt that there was a triangle. Now, if you actually give some coherent motion to the 3 points, you do far better, and you see it as a triangle, and you're doing really well. But if, in fact, they're independent vertices, you may have the feeling that you're tracking an object, but it can't really provide you any help because they are independent vertices. So that was an important model, but that model is kind of overruled by our data of the hemifields. Because there's no reason for you to be able to make objects, and there's no reason for you not to be able to make an object across the midline. And there's nobody who says, I see one object on the left and one object on the right when they notice objects. So the grouping that object percept seems to reflect seems to be a result of the tracking mechanisms, not the mechanism itself. So once you've done the tracking, you kind of notice the spatial pattern that it produces, but you don't impose that pattern to do the tracking. So that hemifield effect was kind of an important result to argue against the object-based thing. But if you did believe the object-based thing, it was still the idea that there's one object, and so kind of does fall into the one object at a time for identification. They aren't two consistent.
Well, thank you very much for a very interesting presentation.
Thank you.